This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you, in part, by Patreon subscribers. Thanks, guys. Get extra after-show Blotter briefs, teehee briefs, and this month, two bonus book reviews by becoming a tipster at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And now, on with the podcast.
Decapitations are rare, usually performed to hide a murder victim's identity. According to Detective John King, that wasn't the motive here.
There was no attempt to hide or prevent identification because they left the head actually on the scene. Usually, if you're going to try to prevent an identification from being made, you would take other body parts, such as the hands or the head also.
Thanks for the tip. I've reconvened the Blotter Presents Book Club this week as crime novelist Alex Segura and I discuss Leah Carroll's Down City and when a crime both is and is not the story. Later, we're looking at the organized crime religion of Yahweh Ben Yahweh and when just marching through the case file is not enough in a third season episode of the FBI Files. Let's try to keep our heads for the Blotter Presents episode 108. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast devoted to the idea that while crime is bad, some of the stories about true crime can be very good. I am joined once again by Alex Segura. Hello. Thank you so much for making time to do this.
Yeah, I'm happy to do it anytime.
You're having a busy one. You've welcomed a new member of your literal family and also a new member of the Pete Fernandez family, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, of my literary family.
Yes.
Well, we're recording this on the day before Miami Midnight comes out, which is August 13th. So that's a little like behind the curtain peek at how this works, I guess.
But, yeah. So by the time listeners hear this, it will be available at all your fine book retailers, I assume.
I hope.
Yeah. Right.
But something's gone awry.
Yeah. Amazon sent me a little nudge.
Oh, good.
Today. It's like, hey, this is out. I'm like, I'm halfway through the one before. Don't break my flow.
Don't ruin this for me, Amazon.
Exactly. Don't judge how slow I am at reading five books at a time. Speaking of books, let's get into our first cold case section of the week and a book that I sped through in a single day. Today we're discussing Leah Carroll's memoir, Down City. The subtitle is A Daughter's Story of Love, Memory, and Murder. I do have a couple of quotes that I pulled. I do want to talk to you about why you wanted to talk about this one. But first, I'm going to read the case file from the back cover. Who were these people, my parents, and how did they come to this place? This one deceptively simple question drives Leah Carroll's gripping memoir of a hardscrabble childhood in blue-collar America, as marked by violence as it was by hope. Leah's mother, a gifted amateur photographer, was murdered by two drug dealers with mafia connections when Leah was 4 years old. Her father, a charming alcoholic who hurtled between depression and mania, was dead by the time she was 18. Leah was left to put together her own future, and now in her memoir, she explores the mystery of her parents' lives through interviews, photos, and police records. That writing is not nearly as good as the writing in the book itself, which yeah. Even like making notes and sort of thinking about discussion topics, I tore through it in a day, and when I had to be away from it, I was thinking about it. Do you want to talk a little bit about why you suggested this one as a topic today?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny. I got lost driving, and I was listening to the audiobook when I was first reading it, and I didn't really want to find my way back, which to me was like a very good sign. And, you know, I didn't really know Leah at the time. We have since become friendly, and she came by one of my book launches, and I awkwardly asked her, I was like, did you record your own audiobook? Because
did she?
Yeah, she did. That's her.
Huh.
She recorded, which has got to be. I mean, the book itself is so poignant and so thoughtful, and it deals with such brutal, like, intense, you know, just visceral stuff. And she writes it in such a personal, like, human way. Like, I think that's what makes it so compelling to read, that this happened to this person, and it's not like Elroy's My Dark Places, where he's kind of out of some mania reinvestigating the crime and trying to, not to disparage the book, but there's some ego in that book, and that he's trying to solve the case. She's not trying to solve the case. She's trying to kind of re-examine the life of these people she didn't really get to know that well.
Yeah.
Which is sad, and also you kind of cheer her on. And the book that comes out soon, my next book, deals with Pete, the PI, kind of reinvestigating his own mother's death, but he didn't know that she was murdered. And a lot of that inspiration comes from this book. I was just reading it, and I was like, this is such a human story. And I'd almost kind of left it in my back pocket, the possibility to write this story about my detective's mom. And so it was just real happenstance that I was reading this really poignant memoir, and I realized that there was this kind of gap in the story.
It's very really hard to do. I mean, I want to talk to you more about your process doing that as a sort of fictional enterprise, mm-hmm. but I think either way it must be extremely difficult to do, and it's absolutely a preoccupation of the culture, whether fiction or nonfiction. Is this story, I don't know if this is one of Joseph Campbell's seven stories, but I do think, like, I believe this comes up in Bosch. Like, I don't know about the books, but definitely in the show.
We just finished season 4, actually.
Oh, nice. What do you think? Do you like that one?
It gets better every season. Like,
yeah,
when it first started, I was on the fence. And just I read the books. I love the books. And there is one of the books deals with his reinvestigating his mom's murder. But season 4, I think, plays pretty well. And so far, we're a few episodes into season 5. And I think it just keeps getting better, which is nice. You don't see that as often.
Yeah, I agree, especially in that sort of noir procedural where you do expect it to get, I don't know, staler,
kind of flatter,
as it goes on. But anyway, my listeners to Extra Hot Grade are probably pretty sick already of my going on about Bosch. So let's.
If you ever want to talk about Bosch, I am here.
All right. We will be. We're both here for you, listeners.
Yeah.
I thought that this was really what I kept writing in my notes was that what she's doing is a lot harder than she's making it look.
Oh, for sure.
Because the book is paced extremely well. The way it's structured, just sort of taking you through Carol's childhood, but also sort of like back into her parents' lives. Before she was kind of sentient, or before she was born, mm-hmm. and then not really bringing us up to the present day. Like, I think between her high school graduation and the present, the book came out in 2017. It's like a page, if that,
right.
Which I think is smart. Just drop the curtain on it, and the prose. I mean, I just kept, when you're reading something this good and compelling, I, as a writer, just am always like looking at it like, how is this being done? And
yeah.
It's not that you can't see how it's knotted on the back, because you can. And there are certain decisions that I'm like, it's not that I disagree with this, but why is she, you know, when she's 5 years old, why is she in the present tense versus the past tense? Why was this decision made? So I think as a reader, I was very affected by it, but also as a writer, it was fun is not a word that we're going to be using really, but it's still compelling also to look at the build. Did you have the same experience?
Yeah, I mean, I read it and then I also listened to it, and I found the prose to be so deceptively smooth and simple. Like, it was just so clear. I mean, yeah. She's a journalist, so that's her background. And this is really a work of very personal journalism, but it never felt overly melodramatic. It was just kind of like, this is what happened. This is how I saw it if I was there. And this is what happened if based on the information I've collected. And it, and then she wove it into this really taut narrative. And I agree. I'm glad that she ended it where she did. And I like the little epilogue where, you know, she talks about meeting her husband and, you know, like, her grandmother and just life after, but it was succinct enough that it fit perfectly as a as an epilogue. But I found the whole thing to just be really impressive in its simplicity, not in a ho-hum kind of way, but it's just like her word choice is very clear and evocative, and it never feels bogged down by like emotion or too much. You know, she obviously, this is her life, so there's emotion, but it never feels weighted down or overwritten.
Yeah, and given that the bulk of what she's talking about is like the excavation of impressions of these people, one of whom she barely knew. Like, mm-hmm. I think if my mother had passed when I was four, that there would be like maybe three or four memories that I could rely on of her, because you're four. And there's so much, you know, there's so much that you're just not aware of or registering or you can't get to as an adult.
Yeah, your brain hasn't really ramped up yet.
So a lot of the impressions that she's rendering, which are, you know, sometimes in a memoir, the recollections are like, this has been writered up, possibly by the editor. She doesn't do that. And that she's able to convey the way a child's or an adolescent's mind works without it being twee or just like one of those Facebook posts that you're like, fuck out of here, from like your high school friends. That it's like, my son turned to me and said, Mommy, why is there hate in the world? And you're like, that shit did not happen.
Yeah, that's when I snooze for 30 days.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of temporary mutes with that. Yeah. But it's like, it is very tempting. Like, it's why we write. It's why we as human beings tell stories, so that we can control the narrative and make it good and like juicy in that way, like perfect what has happened.
It's very tempting, and I can only imagine how tempting it is in nonfiction to kind of squeeze things to fit in certain boxes, but definitely in fiction, you know, especially when you become enamored with your characters, you want to be nice to them and make sure everything,
and not have them do anything shitty or self-destructive.
Yeah, but that's when you know you're doing something wrong. That's when you're doing a disservice to the characters and the reader. But I think Leah was very just matter of fact, which I think as you know, we consume a lot of true crime, so I think we probably both appreciated that because we don't want her like overwrought story, even though it merits that level of emotion for sure, because it's intense. But she did a really great job of just being kind of matter of fact about it and letting us react to it, which is not a lot of people do. I think there's so much true crime that's really overwrought and melodramatic and just like dun dun, and it just doesn't always work.
Yeah, this is going back to what I said before, that what she's doing is actually a lot more difficult than it looks, because you have sometimes two, not extremes, but let's say two different approaches that she crosses the streams and doesn't blow up, which is pretty amazing. And it's the thing that you were just saying, which is like this, I feel like it's like, you know, you're writing to the page count kind of thing. Like, there's some Joe McGinnis books that it's like, nobody cares about the like frozen wheat stalks. Like, just get to it. Like, we know what section we're in.
Yeah.
But, and then there's the, you know, often that's from reporters, journalists who are used to, at their day jobs, perhaps a fairly straightforward and dry recounting. And then you, on the other side of that, you often have books that are just reported, and it can sort of feel like a litany of horror or grievance, and there's no artistry to the chronology.
Yeah, there's no conclusions drawn. It's just like this happened and this happened, and that's it.
Yeah, and you're not moving around. They don't do any moving around chronologically or like sidebars, or there's just no like terrain to the writing, if that makes any sense. You're just like, it's a straight road and you're just trying to get to the end. But because she is a journalist, but also this is a memoir, she combines those two things. And the fact that the writing is often so spare can produce these koans. She's talking about, she's trying to put her mother's drug use in perspective in this section. And she starts this little subsection with, "There's another story about my mother's drug use that I've heard repeated in various forms. It's one of those things you look for, the repeating thing. The thing that after 30 years probably contains some nugget of truth, though it comes in different iterations, because at its heart, it's the same story." I mean, that's a very simple and therefore elegant way. Like, the repeating thing.
Yeah.
I just found myself thinking, like, you know, my parents are fine, as last I heard. Let's just knock some wood. they're still together. No, you know, nothing this tragic occurred in my childhood with them. But, you know, everybody's family has, like,
stuff. Bones.
Yeah, stuff. Bones rattling around in the attic. And as the, you know, default genealogist and sort of family historian who's on Ancestry, this is absolutely something that you're looking for when you're trying to fill in the space that, for example, a grandparent who died at a young age, like my grandfather, that this is what you're looking for, is the repeating thing that tells you the truth about something. And I just had to take, you know, 150 words to say what she just said in 35. I mean, it's really something what she does.
Yeah, and what struck me revisiting the book is that there's really no filler. And you talked a little bit about this in, you know, mentioning McGinnis and how some of his stuff can really, you know, it just goes on. You know, he has to go through every little bit of evidence and kind of recap the entire testimony. And sometimes that's fine, because he writes it pretty well. But, you know, Down City there's no page that I was like, this is boring. You know, this doesn't have anything to do with anything. It all kind of feeds into her bigger story, which I was really impressed by. And she writes it so well. So it's a really a combination of being really succinct and also making each word count, which is kind of the dream.
Yeah, it is.
To be succinct and good. But she does accomplish it with some really tough material.
Yeah. This is how I tended to feel about Toni Morrison, actually. Sometimes, like, reading her stuff and just being like, this is so good that I just want to hit something.
Yeah. You're just blown away. You're just like, how can this exist?
Yeah, you just have to put it down and just go stand, like, in the middle of a room somewhere and be like, well, I'm never going to be that good, so let's just get on with it. Like,
yeah, I'm okay being like number 10, and you're like number
exactly.
one.
Exactly. Like, I'm a strong B plus. I'm like 89. Yeah. That's gonna have to be okay.
Still a passing grade, just not valedictorian.
Yeah, exactly. And that is fine. Yeah, there's a bunch of things that she does that, when you have consumed enough of this material, it is particularly impressive. The way that she evokes I don't know how to put this exactly. Part of it is, like, generally the small spaces that kids stake out emotionally for themselves in adults' lives that may not have anything to do with them, but specifically how much time kids spend in cars, like, kind of being ignored in the car, and the relationship that you have with that space and how it smells. That is the repeating thing sometimes for me in this text, which I thought was cool.
Yeah.
she also has this, I forget exactly what she's talking about, but she like dissolves forward. Like it read like a, like it had been directed like in a screenplay. And that was one thing. There was just like a time jump that was accomplished in four words that was so much harder than she made it look. That was one moment where I was like, okay, I'm just going to get a Diet Coke and contemplate all my many wordy mistakes in my career.
Yeah, that's for the jealousy, like jealousy, but happiness. I'm jealous, but happy for you for being so good.
Yeah. Like I'm glad this exists enough so that I'm not mad that I didn't birth it myself.
She does a really good job, I think, describing the lack of mobility you have as a kid, and yes. Especially a child that is coming out of it's not divorce in her case. I mean, her mother passed away when she was four, but that sense of like not being, you know, I could relate to that. You know, my parents were divorced when I was 10, so there was a lot of like every other weekend you go to dad's, and then, you know, I would spend a lot of time with my grandparents, so I could connect with her talking about, you know, her grandma Ruth and having that really strong bond. And she does a good job of showing that, like how you're almost like living out of a suitcase in many ways. You spend some time with your dad, you spend some time with your grandma, you spend some time, just you get a lot of time by yourself too, because you're not perpetually supervised, which you probably would have been, you know, had circumstances been different. So that kind of fluidity of time, she explains, you know, succinctly and really well, and I could relate to that.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about when she's talking about the way that kids inhabit spaces that like the world is not necessarily for them, and the way that they make space for themselves emotionally. She also has some line about writing, like the writing that she was doing in high school, and how everyone always had quote raven colored hair, and this just like gentle teasing of her younger self. I was like, that's exactly what it was like. You know, of all the people who have earned the melodrama of being 15, it is her.
Yeah, exactly. It's okay. You've got it.
Yeah. I had absolutely no standing for that. I did it anyway.
Yeah.
But, yeah, this was really something. Something.
Oh, good. I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, I really did. It had been on my list for a while, and I'm glad that I was compelled in all the senses of that word to read it. What did you think of, she includes her father's note, this suicide note.
That was hard. That was tough to read. That was, the entire, that section of the book where you're kind of watching her dad degrade and fade away. It's really brutal, and it's just like typical, like, you know, for every alcoholic that finds, you know, sobriety, there's an unknown amount of people that fall into that category that just kind of fall apart, that, you know, gradually, you know, either just die from the illness or, like he did, just take their own life. It's just that was one of the hardest parts of the book to read, just because you know it's coming, you're reading it, and you know it's happening.
Yeah, you know it's happening, and it reminded me of, I don't know if you've read that oral history of Truman Capote.
No.
I've read it many times. I've also read the Gerald Clark, who did the official biography, and it's good, but I feel like this one is better. It's George Plimpton and Gene Stein. I think it's Gene Stein.
Oh, cool.
Who also did Edie, and they did the oral history of Robert Kennedy's funeral train, which is one of the most astounding documents of that time that I've ever read, and I'm always recommending it.
Yeah.
But there's this, someone is recalling, I think one of his agents is saying, you know, he buys a one-way ticket to Los Angeles, and he's basically going out there to Johnny Carson's ex-wife's house to die there. He must have gotten a sense that it was coming. And his agent is like, also has a sense of what's coming, and is like, please don't go. Please go back to Silver Hill. And Capote says, just let me go. I want to go. And they both know what he's talking about. And of course, it being Capote, you know, there at the end, he's just like, you know, we're not going to dress this up. Like, just let the bottle take me, basically, is what he's saying.
Yeah, this is it.
Like, and that's what it reminded me of in every sort of beautiful, terrible way. And also that this note was, I hate to say, like, beautifully, sparely written also.
Yeah, it was really mesmerizing in how, like, not mundane, but how simple it was. It was just like, you know, these are the things that I want to say to you. And it was really impactful. And I got a little choked up reading it because, you know, you're on this hill, you're kind of rolling down and you know where it's going and you know, yeah, what's going to happen. And then boom, you get this note. And it's not even like a earth shattering thing. It's just this somber kind of end note, end cap to the whole thing. And it's really, yeah, it's the book starts off with this impactful, like, death, with this, you know, with this description of what happened to her mom. And then you can almost argue that the ending is just as tough to get through because it's just so drawn out and painful and there's nothing you can do. Like, if someone's going to drink themselves to death, but there's nothing you can do to stop them.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, if you have people in your life who are, you know, sort of safely in recovery, reading something like this and seeing that, like, where that fork of the road ended, mm-hmm, I mean, it's devastating. It's devastatingly effective. And it's just, you know, these are victims also, like, everybody around this.
Yes.
There was just a blast radius of this event, and possibly in the dad's case of Vietnam, there, mm-hmm, there's a whole part of the story that deals with that. But I'm wondering if, I think there's been a lot of conversation in the last couple of years when it comes to, like, meta conversations about this genre. Does a narrative do enough to acknowledge and center the victim in these stories? And what is our responsibility as consumers to choose the narratives that do that? And I found myself thinking, I mean, I think a lot about that all the time doing this, yeah, podcast and the newsletter, but I was really thinking about it with this because I think actually those are the narratives with higher quality. I would have to sort of talk it through and think of examples, but I'm wondering what you think about that. Do you think the best true crime accounts are the ones where the crime is less the story than the other victims, those who survived?
Yeah, I don't know if it's so much those who survived or people who were part of it, like part of the story. Like, you know, like if you want to go back a ways, like Anne Rule, like she's written so many great true crime books, but the one that really sticks out to me is The Stranger Beside Me because she's in the story. She, yeah, knew Ted Bundy, she interacted with him, like they had a friendship. She gained some access to him that, you know, he wasn't giving to anyone else. And it's just like that personal touch makes it so much more compelling. And Carolyn Murnick, who wrote this true crime memoir called The Hot One about her best friend who was murdered, and I did this conversation a while back on Crime Reads. It's really about, like, you know, flipping the script on the dead girl trope. And that's something, you know, there's so many true crime books and so many, like, fiction books, crime books, about just, you know, the grizzled detective and, you know, walking upon this, like, very blonde young woman, bruised and battered. And it's like, well, why does it always have to be this unnamed woman that just destroyed to kind of propel the story of the dude? You know, it's like, it gets boring.
I think Melanie Thernstrom, who wrote about the murder of a friend of hers, called the book The Dead Girl.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think it's much more interesting to get to know the dead girl or get to know the victim and get to know these people. And in Down City, you know, Leah introduces you to every aspect of her life because she's the expert of her life. Like, you know,
yeah.
Who better to tell the story? And I think that adds a layer of emotion and meaning to it that you wouldn't get if it was, you know, unnamed journalist coming to her Rhode Island town to kind of reinvestigate the murder. I mean, I'm sure it would be a fine book.
It would be a completely different story.
Exactly. And you wouldn't get this personal connection that she has.
Yeah, that was sort of the converse of the question that I'm wondering if the best true crime narratives are not the ones with at least memoiristic elements or some kind of personal connection. I say this frequently about documentaries that even when they're extremely personal and subjective, if it's like, I would prefer that. Like, I don't need an objective, court reported recounting of a case.
I feel like I could do that on my own.
Yeah. That it's like, well, I'll just Google around. If that's what I'm interested in. But you could even make this argument that, what makes In Cold Blood so effective is that Capote was like living with this case and immersed in this case and present at the execution and for mm-hmm. years, and writing it like probably killed him.
Yeah. And even like something like My Dark Places, as kind of bonkers Elroy as it is, it's still, you can still see that little boy. You know, you can see what he's, that's, it kind of is the through line of his entire life. You can see in that book, and then in his other memoir, The Hillicker Curse, where he's just this kid struggling to find his mom. And it's so sad. And it's just like, you know, it's really intense. And there's no way anyone else could tell that story but him.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have to say, like, I think there are a lot of books that you could say fit into this genre. There's actually both of Thernstrom's books to an extent. Mm-hmm. Darren Strauss, who wrote Half a Life, about right. That was an accident, but he accidentally killed a cyclist when he was a teenager.
Oh, right.
And the book jacket, I remember thinking, like, is this too clever? That the book jacket, like the dust jacket, was just the bottom half of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, like, that's very clever, but I think it actually might be a little tacky. Publishers, take it easy with that stuff. Piper Weiss, who has been a guest on this
She's awesome.
Podcast numerous times. My Dark Places, of course. Fact of a Body. Michael Gilmore.
You can make a case for Fatal Vision, too. You know, it's really like... and what was the other one that came to mind? Walter Kern's Blood Will Out.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Creepy and bizarre. And you can get a sense that he's not the most reliable narrator either, but...
No, he's not.
It's definitely
but
the
he's a huge bitch, and I am always here for it.
Yes, I'm ready for the next book or whatever he writes.
Yeah.
Sorry, I cut you off.
Oh no, I was basically done. But yeah, I forgot about the Kern. That's an excellent point. But when I look at my the sort of true crime that I return to, I think this personal, subjective, memoristic aspect of it makes it more, not more reliable, but more
more human.
There's like more truth. Maybe there's not more facts, but there's more truth in it.
Or even something like a Wilderness of Error, which is not a capital, not a great book, you know, in terms of
Errol.
Yeah, you know, the things that I found compelling from that book were his personal kind of quest, you know, and I thought, this is interesting. Like, this guy's really into it. And then, you know, having read the rest of the Jeffrey McDonald library, you kind of see that it's inherently flawed, but it's still a pretty interesting book, all those little graphics aside.
Well, and it doesn't always, like, this approach doesn't always work because it isn't always felt. I don't know if you read Skyjack.
No.
Which was about this, you know, one man's like ridiculous obsession with the D.B. Cooper case, which, okay, this reader gets it. I feel you. But some of it really did feel like the editor and the agent and the author all sat down and were like, what's the hook? And it's like, can't he just be interested and not have to have...
Let's make some money.
Yeah, like, let's go to this convention and add a whole chapter at the end. And it's like, you know, it's okay for a book to just be 170 pages, y'all. Like, everybody's busy. Yeah. Stick it in a blog, as we used to say in television. Yes, without pity. So,
just go on long.
Yeah. But this...
Though on the other end of the spectrum, we talked about The Skies Belong to Us, I think. Maybe it was the last time or the time before I was on.
Yes, that's right.
And that's a perfect example of just a really well-researched, compelling story where the author is not part of the story. So I think, you know, it all boils down to good writing, but also it really helps to have an emotional door into what you're saying.
For sure.
At least for me as a reader.
Yeah, I wonder about, because I keep going back to your mentioning Fatal Vision and the fact that I keep acquiring this book and then like lending it to people and never seeing it again. I think I'm on my seventh copy. But I bought one secondhand a few iterations ago, and it was like an early printing before all the epilogues.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, nope, no good. Because I think that's where, like, McGinnis was good at this, but as a pro stylist, like he was like an 81.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I mean, his rebuttals get really tiresome, I think.
Yeah. But that's where
he... And you read Final Vision too, right?
Sorry, what?
You read Final Vision as well.
Oh, yes.
He did.
Still, yeah. It's still on my Kindle. Occasionally I go back and read it because that's where he's like, he is taking it the most personally.
Yeah.
He's the angriest.
Yeah.
He's at the end of his life and he's been living with this case for like more than half his life at this point. So... Yeah, that's...
I thought it would be gone too, because I guess Byliner doesn't exist anymore, but it was still on my Kindle, so I was happy to see that.
Yeah, same. I would have bought it again too, because
yeah.
I'm weird like that. And I could take it as a tax write-off.
Yeah.
But I wonder how Lost Girls fits into our framework, because you don't really see Bob Kolker in the story until the end when he's like, well, I don't have an ending. Which
there's that one brief moment where he's with one of the girls, I think, and she's attacked or something, or there's some level of danger and he has no choice but to like interject himself because he was
right,
there.
That's right. I forgot about that.
But that's really, and it doesn't feel that weird because you're so used to his voice, but it is a little jarring because he's like, hey, I'm Bob, and this happened, and bye now, and he kind of fades back. But then, I think that book falls somewhere in the middle because it really, I think he intended it to be this kind of well-researched work of journalism without him being part of it, but he couldn't help but be part of it because there was no conclusion.
Right. Well, and I think he also was like, well, I'll do this as carefully as I can, but eventually I have to deliver a manuscript and they're just not going to crack this.
Yeah. And they still haven't.
Yeah. But they're making a series out of it and I hope he makes all the money. Because he's awesome.
He deserves it.
Yeah.
He's great.
I agree. All right. Well, folks, I really can't recommend this enough. I gave it 5 stars on Goodreads, which feels like I was talking about this with someone who follows me on Goodreads, that it's like, it can be weird to give like stars to this rendition of a personal tragedy, but it's like, look, she wrote the shit off it. So,
yeah.
You know, what? Can I do not rate it? Her name is Leah Carroll. That's Carol like Carol O'Connor. The book is called Down City, A Daughter's Story of Love, Memory, and Murder. I recommend it. Apparently, the audiobook is just as gripping. And
it is.
There will be a link in the show notes. Moving on to a somewhat less successful, different exemplar in the cold case section. Part 2, we are talking about FBI Files Season 3, Episode 10, Temple of Fear, which concerns the Yahweh Ben Yahweh, I mean, it wasn't a single case. It was like a
crime spree.
Yeah, it was like a multi-tentacled operation. Here's the case file. The Nation of Yahweh, headed by the man formerly known as Hewlin Mitchell Jr., set up its headquarters in Liberty City, Florida in 1979. Broadly classified as a branch of the Black Hebrew Israelite movement, Mitchell's doctrine emphasized the belief that God and all of the prophets were black, and blacks would gain the knowledge of their true history through him. He also characterized whites and Jews as infidels and oppressors. Lastly, he emphasized loyalty to himself as the son of God, or Yahweh. Yeah, that's where these gurus tend to run into trouble. Anyway, yeah. Mitchell's business and charity efforts earned him the respect of the community. The mayor of Miami at that time, Xavier Suarez, declared Yahweh Ben Yahweh Day on October 7, 1990, only a month before Yahweh's indictment for alleged crimes. Yeah, so about those.
A very Miami move.
But he cleaned up a playground. Okay, here come the handcuffs.
Yeah.
Mitchell / Yahweh served 11 years of an 18-year sentence on a RICO conviction after he and several other Nation of Yahweh members were convicted of conspiracy for their role in more than a dozen murders on which it took law enforcement nearly a decade to nail him. Robert Rozier, a former NFL player and devotee of Mitchell's, confessed to 7 of these murders. Mitchell died in 2007. Rozier remains a guest of the state thanks to a check-kiting charge that triggered a 3-strike sentencing statute, even though he had been paroled after killing 7 people.
How do you swing that?
Yeah, he only did 10 years.
Wow.
I mean, he must have given them a ton of dirt. Not that we really hear that much about it in this FBI Files episode, which...
It's pretty light.
Yeah, in the front half, I thought it did a pretty good job, like, laying out the case, and it's just like, and then they did this, and then they did that. But it also really highlights the problems with a very straightforward, then this happened, approach. It's very, and at 49 minutes, it just couldn't hold my attention after a certain point.
No, the format doesn't suit the material, and yeah, like you said, it tries to treat it very linearly, and it's really a book. Which doesn't exist as far as I can tell.
I was looking around like, while I was supposed to be watching and making notes, I was on Amazon looking for other materials.
Yeah, and it doesn't have the, you know, I remember the Yahweh Ben Yahweh stuff when I was a kid in Miami and just being, like, mesmerized by it because it was this creepy, like, cult that was bubbling under the surface of the city, and you don't get any of that from this episode. It's just very dry, and look, that's just the way these shows are sometimes, and they work really well when it's a singular event, you know. This person was murdered, and we thought it was this person, but then it turned out to be this person because of forensic evidence or something, you know, like there's a hook to it. And the hook doesn't really work here because it's such a sprawling case, and it just kind of, towards the latter quarter of the episode, it's just like a litany of, then this happened, then this happened, and then Robert Rozier's in prison. And you're just kind of like, okay, what now?
Well, and I had no memory of this case because it was like the arrests and everything were going down. I'm not from Miami. The big headlines were happening when I was like a freshman in college. I remember like 3 things from that year because freshman in college.
Right.
That one of the things was the pilot of Beverly Hills 90210 does not say great things about anyone, but so I was like, oh well, this sounds like a, you know, massive case that I'm surprised I never heard of. And not only do you have like murders being committed against people who dared to question this cult leader, but they're questioning the cult leader because he's kind of like he has slaves basically. So
yeah.
And you know, he's corrupt, and Lord knows what was going on in terms of exploitation of, you know, youth and ladies of the nation.
Yeah, exactly.
I suspect that some of the locals in Miami at the time, their objection was perhaps not the most, not based on the loftiest ideals.
Yeah.
But the problem with the show is it's sort of, it starts with the finding of a body. And then we heard a clip up top where they're sort of explaining in the driest way possible.
A beheading.
Yes. What a beheading means. Like, well, thank you for that. But in
sounds bad.
Yeah, like that can't be good. It's like, well, this probably wasn't a, you know, ritualistic beheading because they left the head. Like,
this was not a mob killing because they left the evidence.
There's a way to write that's not unintentionally hilarious, and this is not that way. But they at least start off well at the top. That they're like, here's what happened, and here's what we're going to be telling you about. Here's clip six.
Early in the 1980s, a charismatic leader arose in Miami.
Why art thou so far?
He drew the weak, the poor, and the powerless to his side. He promised them a better life, but they had to follow his commands to earn it. His temples soon sprouted across the country as thousands were drawn to his gospel. And those who questioned his doctrine started turning up dead. Local police and the FBI had to stop him.
But this kind of encapsulates both what this show sometimes does well, although not particularly here, and what it does poorly, namely that it gives you a good overview of the entire case. But then it's also clear that they're going to focus on what the FBI was involved in, slash how great the FBI was at being involved in it.
Yeah, it just seemed like they just weren't equipped to handle a case of this magnitude. Like, they really, the bread and butter of the show is singular events and the fallout. You know, and I think I mentioned this before, but my last book was very much loosely based on the Yahweh Ben Yahweh stuff. And while I was watching this episode, I was like, wow, I'm really glad I did not watch this episode when I was writing the book, because it took away a lot of the color and texture of the memories I had of the cult and just like the scarier parts, and really boiled it down into this, I don't want to say generic, but I think there is a Wild Wild Country style documentary about this cult.
That I was just going to say that it needs
telling.
Yeah. Like Wild Wild Country, or the one about the collar bomb people. Why can't I remember the name of it?
Blanking on that title.
Yeah, but it's funny, like Monstrously Evil or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, and that was a really jarring opening episode. But I was, when I watched Wild Country, I was impressed by the packaging, but I wasn't as impressed by the crime, because I was like, okay, they just roofied everyone at the end. Like, there was no like murder spree. Not that I want that, but you know, it starts building to something that wasn't there. Whereas, you know, the Yahweh cult has all that. And I think there's a space for something, for really like kind of curated, thoughtful narrative story that is not this episode of FBI Files.
Yeah. And I guess we have to grade them on something of a curve. Like, this episode of TV, which, you know, is in 4:3 ratio and probably aired in early 2001.
Yeah.
So I think what they're trying to do is like, we have to cram however much story there is. It's got to get in 49 minutes, and it needs to, because the show is called The FBI Files, it needs to focus on the FBI. And in order to get these files, we need to make the FBI look like they played a key role in this story and its resolution. And I'm not doubting that that's true or saying that this is like, whatever, a propaganda film. I don't think that. Yeah. But I also think, like, I think we're in a much better place in terms of variety of media to do something else with this, like you suggested, because there's so many elements to this. There's the fact that this sort of crops up in the late 70s when there are a lot of, you know, there's a lot of disillusionment and people are people are attracted to these sort of idealistic seeming cults. There's the fact that he's using his congregation as slave labor to sell like hair care products.
And using them as kind of eviction enforcers, or like just his little mini army. There's so much to play with. And
yeah,
I don't mean to slag on the show. They have their format, and you know, it's obviously from a different time. And so they were very much just churning out this content, but it's just like a square peg in a round hole. There was so much more to be done with that. And hopefully somebody will do it. That was my big gripe with Wild Wild Country, is that it just built up to this kind of shrug, you know, like then everyone was first and nothing happened. And
right. I mean, cults are bad. Like, well, I think that's usually true, but I'm not sure.
This one didn't seem that bad.
I'm not sure that you, not sure you proved it out with this. There's also in this kind of more traditionalist true crime product, which I think predates Investigation Discovery. That's where it would have lived had that existed, but it was like everything was just on the Discovery Channel.
Was it a sister show to Forensic Files? Or
I think it would have to be.
Yeah, that makes sense.
This narrator cannot touch the helm of the late Peter Thomas's garment, obviously.
All right.
Who amongst us? But it leads to a lot of like unintentionally funny law enforcement, first of all, like rephrasing of things that the narrator just told us, but in cop speak. So yeah. It's like they found something in the car, and then he says the same thing, except he says vehicle because cops.
Yeah.
And then this one, like, I have so many questions about the following clip. Here's clip 7.
We also found a machete that was tucked to the side of one of the sofas in the residence. We immediately became interested in the machete because that could be a weapon to decapitate somebody.
The machete appeared to be clean.
I mean, it's in the... And the way they reenact this, they take it out from between the sofa cushions of this extremely furnished apartment in Miami, like peach sofa.
Because everyone had a peach sofa back then.
I mean, yeah, so did we. Like, that was the 90s. And with, like, the mint cushions. Looked like it belonged on the Golden Girls lanai. And then they take the machete out, and the machete is not clean, first of all. Like, send the prop master out to get a clean machete. And just the way that they're talking with absolutely no humor
awareness
or insight about this machete that they found in the sofa.
It looked like a machete that could have been used to slice someone's head off. It's like, yes, that's usually what machetes are used for in violent encounters. You know, like that's what it
is. And then they feel the need to remind us that there was a decapitation and that the medical examiner had said that it was probably a, you know, not a pen knife. It was something larger, like a machete. Thank you, Simone. Oh my God. Yeah,
definitely not the best funnel for this information.
Yeah, I mean, I pulled another couple of clips, but it's basically the same problem, but it's an interesting contrast with the first thing that we talked about, because this is an extremely dry, like straight as a string road of 50 minutes where it's like, here's where the FBI came in and here's where they locked him up. And that's the whole story as we see it. And it's really a pity because someone has a real opportunity, especially someone who was living there at the time. And not that you have anything else going on, so get on it. Give it some texture and some, you know, firsthand, like,
weight.
Yes, remembered insight. I don't know.
I did particularly enjoy, not for the right reasons, the moment where reenactor Yahweh Ben Yahweh is watching a real clip of of someone in the apartments he just bought disparaging him, and he gets mad and then sends his thugs to attack this guy. But it was such a weird disconnect to watch this actor playing Yahweh Ben Yahweh, watching real, like, found footage, which I wish they had used more of. That would have just made it a little... I'm sure there's fees involved, and they just, like, were on deadline, and it's much easier to just reenact them, I guess.
It's the same, yeah, I guess. Yeah. But that since they were using both...
Yeah, I was just like, why don't you just use more footage of the real Yahweh Ben Yahweh, who was not afraid of being in front of a camera, who was very much into himself. So there's plenty of footage instead of this guy who doesn't really even look like Yahweh Ben Yahweh. He's just like, I guess, part of your crew. I don't know.
Yeah, I had no, and I also sort of got no sense. I just felt a little bit, not disoriented, but like it. There was no sense of place. Like, you and I had been talking about, like, oh, let's do a classic sort of like crime that's identified with Miami. So,
right.
But then from this show, I sort of got no sense. I mean, granted, often a TV show's idea of giving you a sense of place in that way is to put some good old racist castanets on the soundtrack, and you're like, oh, fuck off.
Well, look at these palm trees.
But then it's like, but they mentioned that he was in a bunch of cities, that this church was in a bunch of cities, but then you have no sense of the breadth of the organization or how, you know, is he going to homeless shelters? Is he sending, like, how does a former NFL player end up killing people and cutting their ears off for him?
Yeah, what was his, like, emotional leap? And also, like, yeah, what's the structural setup of this organization? And that's the interesting stuff to, I think, you and to me, is like, how do these cults work? Not so much, you know, they exist and then there's bad things that happen. It's like, how do we get from point A to point B? Because most cults, at least in my research, start off as almost humanitarian. You know, that's how they appeal to the poor and, you know, the downtrodden, because they give them resources. And that's the heart of why cults are interesting, because people fall for it and then become corrupted. But you'd lose all that here. You're just kind of, you find the group in the middle of the story, and there's no care put to explaining how it became what it is.
Yeah. And particularly since when we come into the story in this episode, it's 1981.
Yeah.
And then we're really not told. I mean, he was, I guess, still living when this aired, so fine. But, like, he was about to be paroled.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is shooting fish in the barrel. Like, these shows had their constraints and, like, structure.
Sure, sure, sure.
So,
But, I mean, it is possible. Like, FBI Files, you know, some of these episodes you're like, eh. Like, this was 30 minutes of material in 49 minutes. This one was, like, 3 hours of material in 49 minutes. And then other times it's just the thing.
Yeah.
They're like, here was our contact with Whitey Bulger. Okay.
That's cool.
That was like one of the few renditions of that story where I actually felt like I knew who was on what side of what was going on. Thanks, mm-hmm. FBI Files.
Yeah, sometimes candy's good for you.
Yeah. Yeah, the kind with raisins in it. Boo.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we'll link to that in the show notes. You can watch it on Amazon Prime, and I think it's also rattling around on YouTube somewhere. But if you'd like to watch it legally, narrator, you don't. It is on Amazon Prime. Once again, that's FBI Files Season 3, Episode 10.
Or just take our word for it.
And yeah, if anyone has some like vintage long reads for us, like the Miami Herald did a Sunday magazine insert look back at some point, hit us up.
There's got to be. Now I'm going to have to dig through and try to find something. If I find it, I will let you know.
Oh, absolutely. Please do. Listeners, if you have one off the top of your head or after doing some research, it's at Blotter Presents across social media. All right, Alex, thank you for sitting through that. I hope that revisiting Down City made it worth it.
It did. It evened out. It's a walk.
Speaking of books and revisiting.
Yep.
Please plug your latest.
Yes. My new and final Pete Fernandez novel.
Oh, is it? Okay.
It is. The grand finale.
Okay.
For now. It comes out August 13th, so by the time you listen to this, it will be out, and you can get it wherever books are sold. And it's gotten some nice buzz, not to blow my own horn, but it's it was an EW and the LA Times highly anticipated list, and I think there's more coming, so I'm excited, and people seem to like it. So it was tough to write, because it's always hard to say goodbye to your children, but I think it was a good send-off.
Outstanding. Do readers need to read? I mean, of course they should read the other three. In hardcover, please. Just kidding. Is it necessary to, or can you kind of come in at the end and see him off and then go back and read stuff?
I mean, I write them all as standalones, so I'm not really like snippy about spoilers. So if you jump in on book. If you jump in on book three, you will have book two and book one spoiled for you. But I think readers are smart enough to say, well, this was fun. I'm going to go back and read one and two. So they can all be read individually. My preference, obviously, is that you start from the beginning and kind of enjoy the ride, because I think you'll get more out of it. But I try to write them with both in mind.
I actually jumped in at three because of the McDonald's connection, but I do plan to go back and then forward. So
did you pick up on a lot of the McDonaldisms?
Oh yeah. Okay. I have a little dog ear system. I'm going to force you to sit for an interview with me about that.
Oh yeah, I'd love to.
That one's Dangerous Ends, right? Is the third one. Well, thank you so much for making time right before publication day to come and talk to me.
Yeah, this is my pleasure. Anytime. I'm happy to just jabber on about true crime whenever.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Will Leach is joining us to talk about Mindhunter Season 2 and The Informant! And John Ramos returns to discuss scandals in the world of bridge and con artists in the world of podcasts. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and at Eve Beatty's and my true crime review newsletter, Best Evidence. That's blotterpresents.substack.com. If we get 2,000 paid subscribers, we will cover the Theranos trial in person. My guest, once again, has been Alex Segura, and he is on Twitter at @Alex_Segura. I am Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.